And my brother's like, no. Like, when last time my brother, years ago, we were in Wichita Falls, and I said, well, hey, you know, my grandmother's house right down here. And I had taken to it. And he didn't remember.
Hola, senores and senores.
Como esta?
I start saying random names. I mean, I called roll. Let's see, I'll probably call roll.
You're roll, be roll.
11, 12 times a day for the last 3.5 days.
Year.
Yeah. But the first trip I ever took that I led kids, I left a kid in Target on accident.
And
it was his fault. He walked away from the group. But when I was using the counting method, so 10 people got off, 10 people got on, we're good. Except for when we got on, the bus driver was off, and so I counted him. I did not count him off. That makes sense. And so the kid had walked away from us while we were in Target, and yeah, we're good. His mom was more mad at him than me, though, so I'll take it.
I have kids that will say, you do a roll call, no. To say here for other kids. No, I want you to hear for you.
Yeah, well, so my rule is I have to see your face. Like, I can't, I don't just, like, the here works, but it's more of a, that's just a cue for me where to put my eyeballs. I hate this app does this. It says, do you love the Bible app? And if I say yes, are you going to make me comment? Or if I say no, are you going to ask me for feedback? Ah, no. You're going to ask me for feedback. James, you take a bath this morning?
Yeah, I'm doing the door. Is that okay?
No, I was trying to. I'm not going to miss any chance to. James, come on. Okay. So, this is my last class teaching because, like I said, I can't read a calendar. We leave Thursday, we're leaving for Tampa. Aaron and I are going to cruise, and the kids are staying with their parents. Actually, Alex and Mallory are in camp, so it's all good. I feel like we're missing some people. All big chunk of money. Get back to my notes real quick. Okay. James, you mind leading us in prayer real quick?
Father, thank you so much for this time to be here together, to study your word, to be with brethren, to honor and worship you. Help us to remember that our purpose here is to learn about you and what you expect from us and how to honor and glorify you, to not just be learning facts that we can be proud of. Thank you for your son who gave himself for us, and in his name we pray. Amen.
Okay, so what I miss? I was out Wednesday. What did y'all talk about?
Victories. Lots of victories.
Lots of victories, yeah? Okay. What else did we talk about? Anything else? I mean, the chapter is titled David's Victories, so. I thought it was pretty interesting. Did you get into the David's officials? Who David's officials still are? That's what I think the most that I'm figuring out, because, like, you know, everybody studied Samuel, and you hear the stories out of Samuel, but when you get into, like, the nooks and the crannies, the connections is what is still astounding to me. Like, the connections between this guy, like, one of the guys we're going to talk about that is housing with Mephibosheth is going to come up again in, like, 7-8 chapters when Absalom goes nuts, right, and decides to rebel. And it's just the names that you see over and over again. And remember, why is that sort of difficult sometimes to track? And are there people who might show up more than one time in the Bible, but we don't necessarily know that they're the same person? Yeah, because why?
Well, sometimes they have 2 different names.
Yeah, and 3 or 4 different names. So, like, even with the
Saul Tarsus deck, 4 names.
With what's his name? One of Saul's sons, he had 3 different names because one the name they used, one the name that they was sort of like a pet name, I guess, and then the other one was a name that the translators used because they didn't want to write Baal out in the Bible. So it's sort of interesting. So that's going to be a lot of what we talk about today. But today we're also going to look at the way that David is, these 2 chapters are almost a study in David's character and how he handles conflict, or how he handles, like, I don't want to say political issues. It is a political issue, but it's also how he handles his leadership of a nation versus possibly his individual character. So maybe his character profile as a leader versus as a man, which can be different. You can definitely see that. And we're going to go through that. So I've suggested Mephibosheth as a name for a child. If we ever have another one, and even though Erin knows that it's physically impossible, she still says no. But come on, lady, just keep with me. So chapter 9, we're going to look at David and Mephibosheth. Who's Mephibosheth?
Son of Jonathan.
Son of Jonathan. What is he dealing with in his life?
Crippled in his feet.
He's crippled, yeah. I can't remember the way the word joke was worded, but in one of the translations it says, because Mephibosheth was lame. Not like... and I keep thinking like, oh, that's so lame. Yeah. Just in case you forget, it is going to remind you that Mephibosheth was lame in both feet multiple times in this chapter, and I look for a plausible explanation of why they decided to tell us, to remind us that Mephibosheth was lame in both feet, and it ranged all the way from... it was seen as a curse on him, it was seen as this, it was seen as that, to the far end of it is the author is really trying to make David look better by reminding you that Saul's house is this one guy now who's lame in both feet. So I don't know. There's a whole lot of plausible explanations, but do we know, do we care? Not necessarily, yeah.
Do you think it could be a contrast with the previous chapter where David takes a city and he says David hates the lame and the blind?
Yeah.
And then this chapter it's like, lame.
Yeah, it's sort of like when you hear something that says I hear this a lot with students. They'll say something that might be considered mildly racist, like, but I got black friends, and I'm like, that doesn't really help correct your case, but okay. So yeah, he hated the lame and blind. But he had lame friends. It's cool. Okay, so the first question is, why do we put this story that we're going to come up to here? So let's talk about the story first, and then we'll look at it here in a second.
David,
so,
David just loved Jonathan.
He did, and that's going to be an overarching fact here. And it's interesting how it phrases it, and we're going to talk about that when we get to the end of these first few verses. So in the first verse, David asks, is there anyone still left of the house of Saul to whom I can show kindness for Jonathan's sake? So he says the house of Saul. He could have said, is anybody left in the house of Saul? Because who did he make the deal with? He made the deal, right, that he's going to take care of Jonathan's people. But he also made the deal with Saul, right? And he said the same thing. But it's interesting that he puts that it's stated that way. What else is sort of interesting about this?
He's not supposed to care.
Okay.
He's not supposed to.
Yeah.
Politically.
Politically, historically, advantageously, he shouldn't care. But he does. What else is interesting about this? And I didn't even think about it until about last night. It came to me as a secondary thought. He doesn't know. He doesn't. He doesn't know if there's anybody left. He's asking, hey, is there anybody here? I find that interesting, and it's interesting to me because we know what's going on with every single person within a 50-mile radius that we have a Facebook friend with, right? Because we get that information. And so it's just another reminder that when we read our Bible, we are used to having information about everybody everywhere, and we read that. Sometimes I think we can read that into the text, right? Mm-hmm. That we are a literate culture, and we are a information-saturated culture, right? I'm not even so saturated.
They're not.
What's that?
And they're not.
Yeah, they're not at all.
And David would have been justified saying, you know, Jonathan's dead, Saul's dead, I'm free of this.
Yeah, he didn't know. So, and I think it's important to ask this. And I always remind people of this, is that, like, as far as children go, we live in the safest time period for people under the age of 18 in the history of the world. Okay, infant mortality, the accidents, all that kind of stuff. But everybody seems like they're more scared of all this bad stuff that can happen to kids, right? So a kid 30 years ago was like 15 times more likely to be sexually assaulted. A kid 50 years ago was 13 times more likely to die in an accident or to get a disease that would kill them. The disease part is 20%. If you go back 200% more likely if you go back 200 years, right? No antibiotics. And so, but why is that? So why is everybody so scared of everything right now with kids?
Because it's more widespread known.
Yeah, because you hear about it. It happened more back then, but you never heard about it. But now, it doesn't happen, but everybody hears about it, and even then. So like the Holland candy thing, right? You know how many people have ever been sent to the hospital because of razors in Halloween candy or hurting stuff like, or anything hidden in Halloween candy?
None.
Zero. Zero reports, ever. Like, you can go through the emergency room records. And so there's interesting people that, like, they study sociology. Where did that come from? And it's our desire to know more and to sort of focus on all the negative stuff. So it's pretty interesting. But they didn't have that information. That's sort of where I'm going with that whole thing. I think that's a big deal. So now there was a servant of Saul's household named Ziba. Ziba's going to come up again. We'll talk about that in a minute. They summoned him to appear before David, and the king said to him, "Are you Ziba? At your service," he replied. Remember, that's an interesting way that things are going to play out. The king asked, is there no one still alive from the house of Saul whom I can show great kindness to? Ziba answered, "There is still a son of Jonathan. He is lame in both feet." "Where is he?" the king asked. Ziba answered, "He's the house of Machir, son of Amiel, in Lodabar." And this is interesting because Ziba and Machir are going to both be figures later. Okay? Remember that as we move forward. And so it's interesting, the word here, like in the translation I'm using, it says God's kindness. Okay? The word there is kesed. I can't say it right. I need to get Carl Curtis and have him say it for me. Kesed, right? And so what does that word mean? Where is it used? It's used quite a bit. It means, I got this over here. So the word we're going to get to, I'm just going to show you everything because I didn't put it right there. So kesed is kindness, is compassionate, is covenant loyalty, is faithfulness. And more specifically in the New Testament when it is used, if it ever talks about God's faithfulness for his people, it is that word, right? The providing for it is linked to hospitality. It is linked to that covenant loyalty. When he makes an agreement with a person, he is making that kesed over and over again. And it is a kindness that is not just politeness helping somebody out when they're down. It is a build-up, right? It is a covenant. So, what are you going to say something?
The word did not originally have a religious connotation. It was a word for compassionate, caring concern that anybody could have. You can read about it in the Old Testament. It's used of Abraham and Abimelech in the contract that they made. He talked about your compassion, your kesed, or your, you know. So it's not necessarily a religious word, but it became used for that, and that's how it was adopted by God to refer to his love and compassion for his people.
Yeah. So I think it's interesting that specific word is used, and he specifically puts God's kindness in front of it. Shows that David is still considering God's ways first, and that he made this deal and he needs to do that. So the question on the page back, why do we put this here? Why is this after that big list of victories and his officials, and right before we tell the story of him beating the donkey stuff and out of another group of people, and then eventually moving on to David and Bathsheba?
Well, we see David keeping his word. We see his mercy. We see good qualities here that we see also in the New Testament.
Okay.
Essentially what I was going to say, yeah. David has not forgotten his oaths.
Yeah, he hasn't forgotten those. And I think it's important that I think the author or the person decides that, you know, we got this list of him kicking butts and taking names. We need to remember this part about him too. And I think that's important. So here we go, 6 through 8. When Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, came to David, he bowed down to pay him honor. David said, "Mephibosheth," and what's he say?
"Here's your servant."
"At your service," or "here is your servant." Yeah, that's depends on which translation you're looking at, but that's a response to the king. That's one of those like greetings you don't really think about anymore, right? "At your service," or "at your leisure," or whatever, however people say that. That's what does that mean when you tell somebody you're at their service?
you're at their beck and call.
Yeah, I'm here. I'm here for you. What do you need? Like you are able to. I am here to serve you, right? So David says, "Don't be afraid." Why does he say, "Don't be afraid"? He doesn't say he's afraid. But does it have to say he's afraid? No.
I'm scared to death.
Yeah, he could be like, "Oh man, this is it. Had a good run." So, he didn't have a good run because he's laying on both feet, but still, he had a good.
I'm not an addition to society. I'm an hindrance to society. The king's called me forward. And also here's time to get vengeance. And I'm lame.
So don't be afraid. David said to him, "For I will surely show you kindness." Let's get shed again. "For the sake of your father Jonathan, I will restore you all the land that belonged to your grandfather Saul, and you will always eat at my table." Mephibosheth bowed down and said, "What is your servant that you should notice a dead dog like me?" That self-deprecating is... because where's the dog thing that came in a little while ago? Last time I talked, we talked about, remember, Abner? And when... what's his name? I can't think of his name.
Azazel.
No, the king that Jonathan or David, Saul's other son that gets murdered in his bed. My brain's not working right now. What's that? Ishbosheth. Yeah, when Ishbosheth runs his mouth about Abner, what does Abner say? "My dog's head on Judah." Yeah, so dogs, like, we love our dogs, like, it's, but they use it again. "What is your servant that you should notice a dead dog like me? I'm useless."
Bible doesn't use dogs in a positive manner.
No.
Never.
No.
We do here in America, but really, they eat some pretty nasty things and have a lot of germs and
bread,
soup,
and
yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. He's going to restore everything, right? And we're going to tell the rest of the story pretty quick as we move through because I don't want to get stuck too long on it, but. I think it's important to remember that Ziba, who was seen as a servant, does anybody's translation, several of the ones I looked at said slave. He was a slave of Saul's, or he was a bondsman, anything like that. This is, again, going to be important to remember that the word servant is very, very different from the word slave, and that that translation, translating this to slave to me does not make sense in some of those translations. I don't know. I tried to read some of the justifications. It did not make sense why they said slave. Bondsman maybe makes a little more sense, which is, I think, a little less, more than servant. But it's also, we have to remember too, once again, when you've gone through American history and you look at and you always hear slavery as being a very specific ethnic group, a very specific group of people, and a very brutal system, slavery in our brains is that. But when you look at slavery throughout not the last 200 years, it was always economic based, it was not ethnic. And it's always, it's not necessarily always volatile, I don't mean to say always. It is a system of economic independence. And that we will see the word slave a lot, and it means servant. And we see the word slave in our brains, because the way we learn it, it has a very different connotation than it would if you use the word servant.
It would be more equated to our modern day employee.
Yes. And it was, because you even look back in Deuteronomy, it talks about how you're supposed to treat your slave. And that does not line up with a lot of stuff. So, for instance, when it says slaves obey your masters, I think that is more apt to say servants obey your masters. So, there you go. So, Ziba is a servant. And so, 11, Ziba said to the king, "Your servant will do whatever my lord commands his servant to do." So Mephibosheth ate at David's table like one of the king's sons. Mephibosheth had a young son named Micah, and all the servants of Ziba's household were servants of Mephibosheth. And Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem because he always ate at the king's table. He was lame in both feet. So, Ziba's going to come up again in chapter 16 and 19. Okay? And I'm going to leave that for, I think Travis has that one. He'll come up and he'll be a role because there's going to be an issue with Mephibosheth and there's going to be an issue with Ziba. Oh, is that you? Okay, so James has got that one. And it's sort of interesting how it plays out. And I don't want to ruin too much because it gets into James's thunder. So during Absalom's rebellion, and there we go. So what does this show us about David? I want to give us like a little pause point here. It's okay if you say things you already said before.
He's faithful to his covenants. Mm-hmm. He's kind to someone he really politically, legitimately never should have showed kindness to, should have eliminated him. And yeah. Being lame in both feet would have made him an easy victim.
Yeah, and nobody would have thought bad of an eye at it.
It's just what you do.
Yeah, and being lame like it would have been distasteful mm-hmm. to have around.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a lame guy. He's just, you know, today we look at people like that and we're kind of like, what can we do to help him? Back then it's more like, we can't fix him, that's what he is, and it's distasteful.
Well, remember, what is the question they ask of Jesus? Who sinned that this man should be born lame?
Well, we got to remember why he's lame.
Yeah.
Is when his nursemaid basically threw him out the window.
Yeah.
And then threw herself out the window in order to save his life.
Yeah.
So she saved his life, but at the expense of him being able to walk. And so he is, he's kept himself well hidden from my walk.
Well, and ultimately, he's one of those that we're called to look out for later, and that's the dichotomy of the Old versus the New Testament, right? We're called to look out for the lame, the blind, visit the widows and the orphans. This is true religion, right? Or this is unadulterated religion in the eyes of the Lord. So, and that's, I think that's important. Real quick, I forgot the guy who he's living with, who is Mephibosheth living with? Machir, son of
Emiel.
That's going to come up again, too. And I think that was probably in your area. Machir, son of Emiel, is going to come up in Absalom's rebellion. And he's going to be he's going to be a supporter of David. So it's interesting because you're starting to see some of these minor players mentioned just a little bit. It's like a good book. When a good book introduces a character and you don't think that they're that big of a deal, and then you get four or five chapters in and you realize, oh, man, that is a big deal, right? So he's gonna play a part with that. Yeah.
This also shows that when we don't know how many years this is covering, but David is very busy doing something Saul never really did.
Yeah.
Creating a government. Mm-hmm. Because you have to be able to rule a nation, and whether you're ruling a tribe or 12 tribes or all the other territory and subsidiary countries. That's a lot of work, a lot of administration. And then chapter 8 talked about how that administration folded. And it wasn't just through the temple, it was court administration. He was busy and he was fighting wars. And he wasn't worried about that. I think interesting lesson, you know, probably a lot of people knew about him, but nobody came and told David.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they I think they learned after Saul's death and after
the reaction of the news and the
to the other boy's death is like, okay, let's not go tell David. Let's just leave it alone.
Well, you think that anybody ever like thought, ooh, what I bet if I kill Jonathan's son, that rival, they'll like it. Somebody's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Have I got a story for you? Two stories actually. I think that's important. And I think that state building is important because we didn't really see that from Saul. We saw that Saul made these decisions and he sort of halfwayed everything, and like we said, David is building a kingdom where Saul was waging wars, right? And I think that's an interesting thing to think about. And we're going to see an interesting thing about David and his here. Real quick aside, I read an article last night about the ancient Israel army and how it was always labeled out as the Judah had, like, it was always like, oh, there's 150,000 from all the tribes, and then Judah had 30,000. An argument that that a rabbi made was that it lists out Judah independently because Judah was a standing permanent force where the other tribes would be called up and basically given a duty for a month, right? 11 tribes, they'd cover 11 months, Judah would cover one, but Judah was also there as well. In the central part, that was the important place to guard. It was pretty interesting just reading about the organization. So each tribe would have its own army. And we always see it, we think of like the Greeks and the Roman phalanxes and all that stuff. It would have been, they have the stuff that they provided. it would have been the men that would have been called out, and it's going to be interesting. And so it's important when it says that they called out the army versus they called out the people. When it says they called out the army, they're talking about the professional men of valor, right? The nobles, and the people who have time to train. And when it says they called out all the people, it's the militia, right? It's the, let's get everybody out here. This is a big deal. Because historically, this time period, you're getting into professional armies for the first time, where there will be standing forces, and it's not just everybody who can hold a spear. We start to see that, and there's actually historical historiosity out there that explains that the Babylonians are doing it to the point. The Arameans are starting to do that, which are the Syrians. We'll talk about that. So we're going to talk about Ammon, the kingdom of Ammon, and their capital, Rath Ammon. So what kingdom is like here and down? It starts with what? Nope, starts with an M.
Moab.
Where do you hear the name of Moab and Ammon in the Bible before this? That's a deep cut.
Judges, wasn't it?
Nope. James?
It's the sons of Lot.
Sons of Lot. So, we're going to talk about that here in a second. I'm going to give you the background. But remember that this big chunk is like it. It is. And what's like right here? What happens right here that's pretty important for Joshua?
It's where the cross.
It's where the cross, yeah. So they had to go through the Ammonites, all that stuff. So we're going to talk about that here in a second. Quick history of the Ammonites, just so we know we're talking about. So Ben-Ammi, son of Lot, brother of Moab. When Lot leaves, they set up their kingdoms. They have the patriarch, and that's where they get you to get your names from. Whoever the most important last name was, or the last big important name is, that's who were the, like, you had ites to it, and that's who we get, the Moabites, the Ammonites. So just to make things confusing, the Amorites are who? And it can also be spelled A-M-U-R. There's an Amorite in the Bible that is actually really, really important, and we don't really, haven't talked about in this class. So, the Amorites, there's a couple different things. Amorites are either a specific group of people, or it refers to any nomadic people. So, in some translations, in Septuagint, and in some of the Dead Sea Scrolls, Abraham is considered an Amorite. Because remember, Abraham lived where? Ur of who? Ur of the Chaldeans, which is on the far side of the crescent. They get up and leave. And different Jewish traditions will tell you there's different reasons behind it. Why are we told that he gets up and leaves?
God said to.
Yeah. So he leaves. So the Amorites are a separate group of people. And when I talk about, like, you know, Bible nerds get together and debate some of these things, this is one of them. Like, who were the Amorites? Because you never hear anything good about them. It's always bad stuff. And they're very distinct. And the writers are very distinct in how they separate out, speaking of Amorites and Hebrews, or Amorites and Jews. And that separating them as a people. And there's some very cynical people who think that it's because the Hebrew background is of an Amorite background, and they want to say, no, we're different people. That's different people. But you can see Amorites are in every kingdom. They're called Amur, because it is a way you refer to nomadic people, or people who are sojourning or living in other places, which is interesting. I read a really, really old sermon about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and they're called Emmers, wanderers, visitors, sort of thing. Yeah?
Effectively, then, according to the Bible, we're Amorites.
Yeah, could be. So the Amorites invade just before Exodus and divides Moab and Ammon. So let's go back to our map real quick. The Amorites, the kingdom that they were having is going to be up in this area. They're a highland people. They live up in the mountains. And they wander from place to place. But king comes in, invades this area, and separates them and drives a wedge. Most historians agree that the Ammonites and the Moabites were basically buddies, BFFs. They worked together on most things. They fought like any kingdom would. But they were ethnically joined together because they had brothers as their founders, if that makes sense. But just like any brothers, they fought. Sometimes work together, sometimes. The Ammonites are the perennial enemy here. After who? who's the big enemy most of the time for the Israelites?
Philistines.
But second on that list is the Ammonites. Okay. So they divide the kingdom. The Ammonite harassment of the Israelites is what leads to Saul's ascension. Remember, they picked on who? What city? What's that? Jabesh-Gilead, and they made a deal with the eye-poking guy who's going to come back here in a minute. We're going to get a little bit different of a story about him. And so that picking leads to somebody going to Saul and saying, nope, let's go. Let's go save our people. And he did go out and have that fight. So verse 1 and 2, I gave a little subtitle of the eye gouging guy dies. Remember what was his name? Yeah. Oh, come on, people. In the course of the time, the king of Ammonites died, and his son Hanun succeeded him as king. By the way, something I wanted to throw out there is this chapter isn't exactly identical with a couple adjective changes to 1 Chronicles 19. And so I was doing my prep last night, I was looking at some things, and I clicked a link, and it sent me to 1 Chronicles, and I was actually using 1 Chronicles as the text for a little while, and then I thought, wait, that's not how it says that. And so I flip back, and it's just simple things, and like the way they describe something, the writer of Chronicles sort of describes it versus the way that the writer of Samuel writes. So, in the course of the time, the king of the Ammonites died. His son had succeeded him as king. This is Nahash. Okay, and it's going to bring that up. So David thought, I will show kindness to Hanun, son of Nahash, just as his father showed kindness to me. So David sent a delegation to express his sympathy to Hanun concerning his father. Okay, wait a second. I thought Hanun was the guy that poked all the eyes out of all the men that lived east and pushed the people out of the area, and Saul went to fight because he was harassing Jabesh-Gilead. It is. Same guy. There are several different writings from people who are smarter than me talking about it, about how historically what would have made this change, because he was a scourge of God's people. So what the Dead Sea Scrolls actually mentions, and at the beginning of the chapter where they talk about this, the Dead Sea Scrolls has like 8 extra verses at the beginning that describes why Nahash was such a bad guy. So did he change? Maybe. Did he do something good for David?
David spent a lot of time on the plot.
He did. And so that was one of the times that they did that. So, questions there? We good? So, eye-poking guy dies. David says, I'm going to go send a delegation of respect, which happens. We still do it. And then Hanun's response, the Amorite commander said to Hanun, their lord, do you think David is honoring your father by sending envoys to you to express sympathy? Hasn't David sent them to you only to explore the city and spy out and overthrow it? So, does Hanun come to this realization on his own, or is he sort of goaded that way?
His advisors.
Yeah, and I think that's important to remember, that we don't know what Hanun thought. He might have thought that. And it might be a thing that comes up, but who knows? So Hanun seized David's envoys, shaved off half of each man's beard, cut off their garments at the buttocks, and sent them away. So my question is, when they say half the beard, do they mean like half the beard? Or do they mean like half the beard? There are explanations for both. It's one of those like Bible nerd things, like you want to argue it. But I just thought that was interesting. I was like, is it half? The other thing, why do you cut it off at their butts?
Disgrace them. Shame them.
Immodest.
Okay. The most plausible explanation I heard was that since they're Jewish, they're circumcised. And that would be on display for everybody and the different tribes around them. That was something that was always a derision thing for them. They would always talk about the circumcised or the uncircumcised. So it's the difference between there. And so that being on display is a display of who these people really are. The beard thing, everybody had beards. Like there was a surprisingly long article about beards in the ancient world and how that was a big deal. Pretty neat. Talked about all the different like Babylonian beards and how in Egypt, even when they had a female pharaoh, she would have a beard. Like she would attach a prosthetic beard to her face because it was seen as a symbol of authority. Interesting. So when David was told about this, he sent messengers to meet the men, for they were greatly humiliated. The king said, stay at Jericho till your beards have grown, and then come back. So this is one of those verses I wish we had more info on. Like, was it? Did he do that because it was a personal thing for the people, the men? He didn't want the men to be embarrassed by their situation? Was it that he didn't want to be embarrassed by having them around as reminders of what happened? There's a whole bunch of different explanations for this. This is one of the verses where, like, why Jericho? So Jericho hadn't been rebuilt at this time yet. People are living there because there's a big spring there, but it's not been rebuilt to the city that it was, right? So, questions there? Comments?
Jericho was probably the first secure Jewish city they came to after they left the Ammonite territory.
Yep. So because they would have come from here and gone. And then Jericho's about right here. So, Jericho geographically, even just taking out what the Bible says about Jericho and its importance, geographically, Jericho is a majorly big deal because of the spring. And it's a natural crossroads where you can come up through one of the, I don't go back to the map, but if you look at it, you can come up out of the valley of the Jordan Valley, and it's a relatively safe pathway up. It's not a straight down escarpment, so it just makes sense. It strategically is a very important city. I think I read an article once about Jericho, and when, you know, had they always looked at the layers, Jericho has been burned at least 13 times in its history by different people, and each layer has like a different record of who it is. Like, so, oh, here's a burned spear that we know is attached to the Babylonians, and here's one that's this, and so sort of that superhighway thing. So the Ammonites realized they messed up, and so, yeah. Well, so I think
was gonna happen.
Well, I know, and it's that understatement thing. I think it comes back to. And so the translations are different. I like this translation. When the Ammonites realized that they had become obnoxious to David, they hired 20,000 Aramean foot soldiers from Beth-Reab and Zobah, as well as the king of Maacah with 1,000 men, and also 12,000 men from Tob. So what mine says, they realized they had become obnoxious. What did you all say?
Odious.
Odious, yeah.
Repulsive.
Repulsive, yeah, that's another one. I just love that it's like obnoxious, because that's what I tell kids all the time. I love you, but you're obnoxious. Like, I'm ready for you to leave. Go. That understatement just of that translate, that word is great. So they hire a bunch of soldiers. Arameans, who are they? What does that sound like we're going to hear about later? Well, I'll just ask an easier question. What language did Jesus speak?
Aramaic,
right? Which is... the closest language we have to Aramaic now is Syrian. And the Arameans are Syrians, okay? I tried to look up where that came from, but didn't find it. So, I'm hearing this. David sent Joab out with the entire army of fighting men, and the Amorites came out and drew up the battle formation, the entrance of their city gate, while the Arameans of Zobah and Rehob, the men of Tob and Maacah were by themselves in open country. So you had a group in the city, the Israelites, and then who? All these extra guys, right? And so Joab is looking to be in a not great position, okay? And when it says at the entrance of their city gate, that means they're outside, okay? So city, army, 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 okay? That's sort of important. And so they get a plan. We're going to talk about that here in a second. So verse 7, I didn't want to talk about that. Don't be afraid, David said to him, for surely show your... wait, I'm in the wrong chapter. Mephibosheth was not there. On hearing this, David sent Joab out. The Amorites came up and drew the battle line. We're going to jump down to verse 9. There we go. So Joab saw that there were battle lines in front of him and behind him, so he selected some of the best troops in Israel and deployed them against the Arameans. He put the rest of the men under command of Abishai, his brother, and deployed them against the Ammonites. And Joab said, if the Arameans are too strong for me, then you are to come to my rescue. But if the Ammonites are too strong for you, then I will come to your rescue. Be strong and let us fight bravely for our people and the cities of our God. The Lord will do what is good in his sight. So what's that mean? What's interesting in there is, if those guys are too strong for you, I'll come help you. But what's he going to be busy doing?
Fighting his own
people, right? And so, and then it goes on to say, so Joab leads the army against the Ammonites. He defeats the Ammonites, right? And they, what? Run back to their, because the Ammonites are standing at their city gates. They go back into their city, right? So Joab and the troops with him advanced to fight the Arameans, and they fled. When the Ammonites realized the Arameans were fleeing, they fled before Abishai. I said that backwards, by the way. Joab leads against the Arameans, which is important because those are probably the better soldiers. They're mercenaries. They know how to fight. And so, yeah, don't pay attention to this. I'll fix that in a minute. So what happens is one group routs, and the other group on the other side says, nope, not going to do this. Right, and so they group up, and then Hadazer had Arameans brought from beyond the Euphrates River. They went to Haim and Shobak. The commander of Hadazer's army led them. So they whooped them both, and the Arameans, who are mercenaries, call for what? They call for backup, right? They bring in more people from beyond the Euphrates, which is where they would have come from, which means just from away. And then when David was told of this, he gathered all Israel. So men, women, children, right? No, that's that phrase again. That means he gets all of the army, all of the garrisons, and he goes out, right? And but they fled before Israel with David and killed 700 of their charioteers and 40,000 of their foot soldiers. But he also struck down Shobak, the commander of the army, and he died there. And when all the kings who were with vassals of Hadazer saw that they had been routed by Israel, they made peace with the Israelites and became subjects to them. And this is my favorite line here. So the Arameans were afraid to help the Ammonites anymore. Like, it's just a good thing. Like, a friend of mine is, he was in the military, and then he became a mercenary with a group, and he said there are certain people there they will not provide security to, because it's not the right person you want to defend, right? And he said you'd see it all the time in, he was in Afghanistan, they'd have a group of mercenaries helping a group, and as soon as they looked weak, the mercenaries were like, nope, we're out, we can't help you no more. And that's sort of what you see happening here. So David's going to see their weakness. He's going to see, hey, we stomped them the first time. Probably do it again. Let's go. But what does that say? David was not with them at the first part, right? He sent Joab instead. So I thought that was pretty interesting. So there's conflicting numbers here. I told you this is an exact replica almost of Chronicles. So this thing says how many charioteers they killed.
700.
How many does it say they killed in Chronicles? 7,000. Most people attribute that probably to a scribal error. Instead of 700, they just added an extra zero. It was a 7,000. Or they left the zero off one way or the other. Either way, it's a crushing defeat. It's a lot.
Just the number 7 has the idea of complete and utter.
Correct, yeah.
So it really doesn't matter how many zeros they put behind it.
Yeah, it's just the idea, yeah. And that's one of those...
complete and utter destruction of their chariots.
Correct. So the Arameans were afraid to help the Ammonites anymore. They lose their access to their people. I want to throw the two views of David up here with the Ammonites. With Mephibosheth, he's looking to honor his agreements. He remembers, hey, I made this deal. I wonder if there's anybody else left. And he's seeking out ways to do kindness, which is important. I think that's important to us. We need to remember that that is a big deal. We should be looking out ways. One, we should be honoring our agreements. And two, we should be looking for ways to provide, to do kindness. And not just to be kind, but to the idea of a do kindness thing, right? And then with the Ammonites, he's looking to repay respect, right? And he's responding to the disrespect, but he responds to that disrespect, right? Should we do that? No, I'll argue that David, as a king, as the head of an army, and as the head of a nation, has a different way of responding to disrespect to God and his people than we do. Not our job. Our job is not judgment. Our job is not to repay the disrespect. Our job is to what? What are we told?
Turn the other cheek.
Turn the other cheek, right? And I think that's important to remember as we move forward this.
Okay, what if he hadn't responded?
I think it would have led to the Ammonites, the Arameans, and everybody in that what-if situation, they would have seen his weakness. And he had to set that up. So here's my question real quick. How did David's dad die?
You said I don't
We don't hear about him until, again, after David leaves him with who? The Moabites. Tradition says that the Moabites killed him and his family, and just one of his sons got away. One of